So, questions before we start? Yes. The write-up that shows, basically, you know, apart from just throwing the numbers that you got from the search thing, I mean, you can talk about whether or not they are in line with what you expected, and are there actually surprises. So for example, let's say if an informed heuristic wound up doing more expansions than a less informed heuristic, that's a surprise, and you need to kind of figure out why that is happening. And if the informed heuristic did do better than normal heuristic, then you can explain that, and that part at least as expected. Okay. I have seen, I mean, I think for just the 10 problems and the analysis, you could probably do it in a couple of pages. But, you know, I have also had people do extra credit and write multi-page reports with graphs and so on. You know, it all depends on how seriously you take your program. Okay? That's basically the idea. So there is no upper limit. yeah. But I think also, I think the grading would essentially will take into account the analysis you did. So even if your project is completely running and you got all numbers, you will still probably lose a lot of points if you haven't looked at what those numbers are telling you. Okay, so that much is for sure. Other questions? Yes. So how are people doing in terms of actually being able to complete by Thursday? So these are all people who are done, right? Okay. No. I mean, some people actually lifted their hands and they are done. I mean, they probably don't want to lift it again because they want to survive the rest of the semester. It's fine with me. So I would do it this way. Let's say that since this is the first project, and since I really want you guys to write a good report as to, you know, not just the, you know, project is working, okay, I will take it until Tuesday, okay? And then you spend the extra time, and actually I'm hoping that those of you who haven't gotten the code working, you still actually, you know, benefit from it, but this wasn't actually meant for you. You know, the people who have the code working should actually be able to spend the time and, you know, analyze it, okay? However, I will give out the project too on Thursday. So if you're done on Thursday, you know, give you a project and you can move on with your life, okay? I also want you to understand that this is the first project, and since it's a large class with pretty, you know, varying Lisp competences, I'm doing this. Don't expect that it will happen every project, okay? Because we do want to do some number of things before we get done with the semester, okay? We might have a more a different kind of an outlook for the rest of the projects, where I might just give everybody some number of extra days that they can use as they see fit, okay? And then, you know, if they don't use it, they don't get anything out of it. It's like the stimulus package checks. You know, we'll do something like that. But for this one, it's across the board. I'll take it until Tuesday and at the beginning of the class, as usual. Okay? And use that to kind of analyze the results. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, both of them on Tuesday. Both of them on Tuesday. Okay? Both of them on Tuesday. Since I somehow by mistake combined them. Both are on Tuesday. Okay. Okay. Other things. Okay. So, what we were doing last class basically was inference. Towards the end of last class, we were doing inference with propositional logic. We looked at a variety of inference rules that are sound but not complete. And then basically you can show that they are sound by essentially using the truth table enumeration method. And then once you show that that pattern of inference is sound, then you can use it forever. Okay, so this is, for example, sound. This one is not sound because after two worlds where the knowledge base is true, only one of them is the theorem true. And so it's no longer sound. Okay, we talked about this. And then we also talked about the fact that you can easily make, in fact, what's the simplest sound inference procedure which won't require much of a thought? You already have a whole bunch of sound inference procedures which are not complete. So if I don't care about soundness, I mean completeness at all, then what's the simplest sound inference procedure? What? Not false. Not false. If you say false, you're in trouble. Just keeping your mouth shut, okay, which is most of you, you know, do this when I ask questions. And, you know, if you don't open your mouth, you can't be wrong, right? Right? Unfortunately, in the exam, that doesn't help. You know, not being wrong is not good enough. You have to be right, too. Okay? So sound basically means, so is P true? Is Q true? Is not P true? That sound, because you never opened your mouth, you can't very well make any mistake. Okay? And similarly, you can get complete but unsound rules. And then essentially just saying yes for everything. And then is P true? Yes. Is not P entailed? Yes. Is Q entailed? Yes. Everything you say yes, and then obviously you have said yes to also the ones that are really derivable. I mean, are also the ones that are actually entailed, okay? So, of course, the quest is to get something that's both sound and complete, and we talked about the fact that, so, you know, where in this particular case, you know, W implies J, not W also implies J, and you want to be able to show that J is true, J is entailed, okay? And neither of these by themselves can allow you to prove it. Although there is this idea called natural deduction where if you use all of them, one after other, you will be able to prove this too. But if you are talking about just a single inference rule, then you will not be able to prove, you know, that J is entailed using any of those single inference rules alone. However, we talked about basically what you need is a case analysis where you need to realize that either W is true or W is false, and if W is true, then J is true. If W is false, then J is still true, and so overall it's true. Okay? And then the case analysis, the rule that allows you to do that is the resolution rule, and the resolution rule essentially takes everything in the clausal form, and this is not a loss of generality because everything can be put in clausal form. And we will talk about how, you know, again in a minute, but it's not surprising that pretty much everything you can write can be put in clausal form. And so, for example, I can write, so if I have A or B and not B or C, then I can resolve B and not B away and write A or C. Now, in this particular case, resolution rule is actually a generalization of all the other rules we have seen, it turns out. So, for example, you know that modus tollens says A implies B and A implies B and not B means not A. Right? That's modus tollens. If A implies B and B is definitely not true, then you know that A must definitely not be true. Okay, now can I show that using resolution rule? You can, because this is nothing but not A or B, and this is not B. You resolve those two, you get not A. Okay, so in fact, resolution is a more general rule, which basically subsumes all these other rules. Okay. So now, the interesting thing is, of course, how do you use resolution to prove the theorems? If you want, you know, if you have a knowledge base KB, you know, and you want to prove is alpha true, you can do two different things. So first of all, the step one is always put KB in classal form. Okay, I'll spend a couple of minutes in the next slide, you know, showing that there's just a sequence of steps that you can use basically mindlessly to convert anything into causal form. Okay, but you probably are not surprised. I already did that there. A implies B is nothing but not A or B. Okay, so the question is that you should put it into the causal form, and then you want to see whether, you know, you want to show that alpha is entailed or not. You know, and to do that, you essentially can use resolution. You can use resolution in two different ways. The forward way is you keep taking clauses from the knowledge base, resolving them if they can be resolved together. Whenever you get a resolvent, then you add it to the knowledge base and keep doing this until at one of the points you are able to show the alpha actually comes out as a resolution of one of the things that, you know, you resolve. You understand what I'm saying? So KB is in the causal form, and then you take two clauses from it, resolve them if they can be resolved, and put their result back into KB, and then keep doing this until you happen to, you know, get alpha as a derivation. That's called forward resolution. The opposite, the other idea is backward or refutation. Our resolution refutation. What resolution refutation does is, since you're trying to prove alpha is entailed, okay, since you're trying to prove alpha is entailed, if I were to add not alpha to the knowledge base, then it must be the case that the knowledge base is inconsistent. Right? That's what we were talking about. In fact, last class we talked about how we could use truth table methods to show that alpha is entailed. One way to do it is to have a column which says KB and not alpha, and then that column just becomes alpha if alpha is really entailed. Okay, so what I want to do is I'll add not alpha to the knowledge base, and then I keep doing resolutions now. I no longer have to check if any of the answers is alpha, because not alpha has already been added. What I need to check is I'm able to prove false. Okay, to show in a propositional logic, a knowledge base is inconsistent if it entails false. Okay, now the interesting question, of course, is in the causal form, how does false look? In the causal form, false looks like an empty class. There is nothing in it. So, for example, if I have A in my knowledge base, not A in my knowledge base, then I can resolve A with not A. A in A is gone. There's nothing left. Okay? So I basically get empty class. And if you are confused as to why that could be true, you can always realize that really when I have something called A, I can always write it as false or A. Okay, and similarly, if I have not A, I can write it as false or not A. And then if I resolve these two, I'm getting false or false, which is false. So you never write false. It's always there. It's hanging around in the class. Okay, so in the backward resolution refutation, all you're trying to do is derive the empty class. If you ever derive the empty class, then the theorem you're trying to prove is actually proved. Now, here's my question. What if the original knowledge base itself has an inconsistency? Then you would be able to derive the empty class even before alpha has been added. Does this create a problem? No. Why? Because if the original knowledge base is empty, I mean, original knowledge base is inconsistent, then it actually entails everything. Okay, in logic, once there is an inconsistency, then every theorem is entailed from then onwards. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so, in fact, even though we assume that in normal knowledge bases, KB in itself would not have led to an empty class, And so if there is an empty class, it must be because KB and not alpha together. Okay, but it's fine if the knowledge base is actually inconsistent to begin with, because then trivially it ensures that everything is true. From false follows everything. And I was telling you last time that, you know, most of the, you know, mathematical fallacies essentially will involve doing something that's inconsistent, and from there you'll be able to show 1 equal to 2, 5 equal to 9, and all that fun stuff. Okay? So there are two ways of these doing, and in fact, more often than not, you tend to use, if you're trying to prove a theorem, you tend to use resolution refutation. If on the other hand, you're trying to just do constraint propagation, for example, I mentioned at the end of last class that forward checking can be thought of as essentially doing a little bit of resolution. Okay? And so that would be essentially, in doing so, what you are doing, the, you know, resolution, and a few steps of resolution in the forward direction. Okay? But for now, we'll spend more time looking at the backward resolution refutation, because that's what you use to prove any theorem. And it turns out to be more general in the sense that there are more cases where, I mean, so basically, this, if you're just doing forward resolution refutation, forward resolution, then sometimes you may have to still do some minor simplifications to the knowledge base such that you'll actually get alpha in the end. Okay? Whereas in this way, all you need to do is just keep doing resolution, and then if you get an empty class, you're done. Okay? So all of theorem proving with resolution refutation would be a mad chase for empty class. Okay, and so if I ask you to prove a theorem, you will find that you are doing random number of, you know, random pairs of classes, desperately trying to resolve them, hoping for an empty class to happen. And since you want an empty class under time pressure, you actually make empty classes come out of woodwork, even when they are not there. And then that you shouldn't do. We'll actually look for some silly mistakes people do when they first start doing resolution refutation. But we'll get there in a minute. Let's look at this example. We wanted to prove this using resolution refutation. Okay, if I do it in the forward direction, I would just, you know, resolve W and not W. I'll get JRJ, and then I have to actually simplify JRJ equal to J. So that's an extra logical equivalence. You have to use it to realize that J, in fact, is followed. Okay, this is obvious to you, but it's not obvious to your computer, so it needs to use logical equivalences as part of the theorem proving. If on the other hand you want to do it in the backward direction, then all you need to do is add not J to the knowledge base. So not WRJ, WRJ and not J. And then not J and WRJ, not J and not WRJ, these J's cancel out and I get a not W. And this not W and W cancel out, I get a J. And the J and not J cancel out and I get an empty class. Okay, this also shows you, for example, that the same thing can take part in multiple resolutions. Nobody stopped you from doing that. In fact, in this particular case, you started with not J, and which is connected to this, will give you not W, which then will give you J, which is inconsistent with your original assumption that not J is true. That's why you get an empty class. Okay, so now whenever you get an empty class, then you are done. Then you have basically proved that it's not right to assume that, no, it's not right to assume not J is, I mean, so you cannot, so what you basically proved is it's not, if you add negation of J to the knowledge base, then the knowledge base becomes inconsistent, which means knowledge base is indirectly telling you J is true and you're just not realizing it. Yes. Which one? Because this one, right? J and not J get cancelled out, so I get not W. That's it. That's all resolution does. Okay? So now, of course, to do this, in this particular case, I put everything in the clausal form already. So the question is whether is it true that any possible propositional logic statement can be put in the clausal form? Answer is yes. And so the question is, first of all, you actually can talk about what are called canonical or normal forms, and there are multiple of these, and some of the normal, sorry, there are at least three normal forms, of which two are canonical. Canonical means every possible sentence can be written in that form. Okay, it's worth looking at them. So one that we are most interested in is the conjunctive normal form, which is the product of sums form from your triple E120. Okay, product of sums form. Okay, because each R is a sum, and then if you AND it, it becomes a product. Okay, so that's basically, each clause is a disjunction of literals, and the entire knowledge base is a conjunction of these clauses. And you don't write the conjunction explicitly. By just putting another clause into the knowledge base, you assume that it's been implicitly conjoined. Okay, and the other normal form is disjunctive normal form, which is a product. This basically is the sum of products form. So each clause is a conjunction of literals, and the knowledge base itself is a disjunction of these conjunctions. Okay, in fact, disjunctive normal form. So if remember that I told you that it's best to think of each sentence in any formal language as just a stand-in for all the words where it is true. Right, that's what, a sentence is really a set of words where it is true. Okay, the DNF comes very close to writing that particular set of words explicitly. That's what it does. In the propositional logic case, so if you write DNF form, it's basically a conjunction, it's a disjunction of conjunctions. And each conjunction is a word, in essence. So you're saying it's true in this world, and this world, and this world, and this world. Okay, so DNF forms tend to be huge for arbitrary sized, arbitrary knowledge formulae. DNF form can be quite big. Okay, but one of the nice things about DNF forms is that since you're almost saying it's true in this world and this world and this world and this world, then you can ask certain questions much. You can answer certain questions much more simply because it's sort of a more extended representation of the fact. We won't look at DNF forms in this part at any rate. We might look at it later on, but we won't care about it right now. Okay, there is another form called Hahn form. Okay, in a Hahn form, essentially, you have the definition of Hahn form is that if you put the knowledge base in the clausal form, when I say clausal, normally I mean CNF. Although these are clauses, normally it's when people say clausal form, they mean CNF. Okay? If you put your knowledge base in the clausal form, then as long as no clause contains more than one positive literal. Remember, a clause is a disjunction of literals. A literal is either an atom or a negation of an atom. A proposition or a negation of a proposition. Okay? As long as every clause contains less than or equal to one positive literal, then you are guaranteed that the knowledge base that you have is in Hahn form. Okay, why is Hahn form interesting? Hahn form is interesting because if that is true, then in essence your knowledge base is of the type A and B implies C, C and D implies J, G, G and A implies K, that sort of a thing. Okay, now if you take any of these, for example, if you take this and convert it into the clausal form, what would you get? You would get not of A and B or C. Right? This you can take it as not A or not B or C. You only have at most one positive literal. How can I get more than one positive literal in normal implications? One way of doing it is to say A and B implies C or D. Right? If you do that, then I'll get not A or not B or C or D. If you ever have these kinds of implications in your knowledge base, in essence, you will be forced to do case analysis. A and B implies either C or D. Now, if C is true, certain things will hold. If D is true, certain other things will hold. As long as what you want to prove is in the intersection of both cases, it's proved. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is a non-Hahn clause. this is, you know, if you forget about what is the reason for Hahn clauses, then Hahn clauses are essentially like the normal prologue rules that you may have read off. You know, if you know prologue, then essentially there's a head and there's a tail. So this is the tail and this is the head, and head only has one thing. Now, I said A and B imply C or D. Why didn't I say A and B imply C and D? Is that Hahn clause? A and B implies C and D. Yes, it's a Hahn clause because this is equivalent to A and B implies C, A and B implies D. Okay, so conjunction is fine in the head. Disjunction is not allowed in the head. Okay, now the interesting thing is not every sentence is Hahn, right? Because I just showed you some sentences which are not Hahn. This one is not Hahn. So Hahn clause normal form is a restrictive form. It's not true for every knowledge base. However, if it is true for your knowledge base, then you live in a happy world. You don't need to do case analysis. Okay? In particular, if your entire knowledge is Hahn, that means, you know, you just know what you know about the world. You lucked out and it turns out that everything actually is Hahn. Okay? You don't know any facts of this type, essentially. In that case, you don't need to do resolution. You can just do modus ponens and you will be able to prove every theorem that is provable in your knowledge base. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, so if in fact your knowledge is Hahn, your life is simple. It's a tractable subclass of propositional logic. And when we go into the first order logic, all of these definitions will carry over with small generalization. Okay, and if your knowledge base in first order logic is in Hahn form, then you essentially get to do prologue style reasoning with your first order logic. Prologue is actually a little more than just modus ponens. It also has, how many of you have heard of prologue? Okay, so those of you who know prologue know that apart from the usual head and tail, it also has this cut operator. That changes prologue a little. It also has something that we'll say in a minute called negation as failure. Okay, so if you can't prove something, then you assume that the opposite must be true. But that's like lazy person's way of living life, right? You know, I mean, can this theorem be proved? I tried for 3 seconds, it didn't, you know, I couldn't prove it, so it must be that its opposite is true. Okay, but if those two are added in prologue, but if you remove them, then essentially prologue is a Hahn clause theorem prover. That's what it is. And to make your life really happy and foreboding, your fourth project would be writing your own prologue interpreter. Because we'll get to first order logic after we go through probabilistic propositional logic. And so we will learn to love Hahn forms by that time again. And you would actually be able to do your own prologue interpreter, basic prologue interpreter, without all this cut and nonsense. Okay? So this is restrictive form. These two are non-restrictive forms. And we came into this slide because we want to be able to use everything in clausal form to do resolution. Okay, and if I'm doing resolution, then and the question, of course, is I think you agree already, probably in your heart of hearts, that everything can be converted into this form. But I'll show you, you know, a little set of, you know, a sort of a cookbook recipe for converting anything into clausal form. Okay, so if you have a CNF clause, so if you have an arbitrary propositional formula, then the way you convert it into clausal form is first you remove implication. You can always remove implication. Not remove doesn't mean just remove it. You know, to remove the implication, you need to write not of the tail or the head. A implies B would have to be written as not of A or B. Remember, the reason this makes sense is when you put everything into the clausal form, really, there's only disjunction and conjunction left. And conjunction is implicit. Because you know, all the clauses are conjoined, okay? And the disjunction is within the same clause. So you want to get rid of the implication, that's what we did. The other thing is, in the clausal form, you never have things like not of A and B or C. Negation is at most to a single atom, because a clause is a disjunction of literals. So you have to pull the negation inside. You know how to pull negations inside. Okay? If you have a negation over A or B, so how do you pull negations inside? So basically, once you got rid of implications, then only things that are left are conjunctions and disjunctions, right? Okay? If a negation is not applied directly to a single atom, it must be because it's being applied to A and B, or it's being applied to A or B. Okay? If it's applied to not of A and B, how do I pull the negation in? Your De Morgan's law says it's not A or not B. Right? And if you've forgotten this, just do it in set theory. You know, it's not that hard to prove this to yourself. And is this in clausal form already? In this particular case, it's already in the clausal form. How about this? Not of A or B. It becomes not A and not B. Right? Is that in the clausal form? Pretty much, because you take this and write it as not A, not B, that's in clausal form now. Because there are two clauses, each of size 1. And conjunction is implicit between the clauses. Okay? That's all you do. So, pull negation in, and basically, and also, sometimes if you have things like A, R, B, and C, if you have things like that, A, R, B, and C, you can take this inside, right? You can say A, R, B, and A, R, C. And those are two different clauses now. Okay, that's what this rule is saying. So if you do this repeatedly, then you will come to a point where everything is essentially a sort of a conjunction of clauses, where each clause is a disjunction of literals. Okay? And this is basically doable for anything, any particular knowledge base, okay, in propositional logic, because this is a canonical form. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is kind of use this in a reasonably large example, which will start happy, but then will, you know, make your head spinning, because, you know, in looking for match, you know, for an empty clause, you will have to desperately take every pair of clauses and mess it up to look for some empty clause somewhere. Okay? And you would be surprised at how many steps of resolution might be needed to prove something that's reasonably obvious to you. Okay? So here is my little knowledge base. Okay? And I want to prove, so my knowledge base says if the grass is wet, then it's either raining or the sprinkler is on. Okay? And if it's raining, then Timmy is happy. If sprinklers are on, then Timmy is happy. If you saw Timmy sitting outside near the, you know, fountains when I just came into the class, they're really happy because the fountains are going and they're just going into the water. Okay? And if Timmy is happy, then he sings. And that kid was singing, believe it or not. Okay? I saw him. And then right now, Timmy is not singing. In the world that you are in, Timmy is not singing. Okay? Prove that grass is not wet. You understand what I'm saying? You can see that. I mean, you can use your own brains to realize that, you know, grass must not be wet, because if grass was wet, then Timmy would have been, you know, if grass is wet, then it's either raining or the sprinklers is on. Let's see, wait. If it's raining, then Timmy is happy. If the sprinklers are on, also the Timmy is happy. If Timmy is happy, then he sings. Timmy is not singing. Right? So basically, in this case, I said GW implies R, R, S, and these two together are essentially able to let you know that neither R nor S is true. So using modus tollens, then you can prove that the head is also not true. Okay? That's all you want to do. Now, I want to go in steps because, you know, just basically, and we will do resolution refutation, which is convert everything into the clausal form. First, convert all of these into clausal form. Then convert this into clausal form and add it, and then look for empty clause. But even before that, actually, before writing it into clausal form, you do have to actually represent this knowledge in some propositional logical statement. Okay, so first we will write it in the more normal propositional logical statement, the natural way of writing it, and then convert it into clausal form. Okay, so that's basically, if I assume that GW is the proposition which stands for grass is wet, and R stands for rain, SP means sprinkler, TH means team is happy, and SG means singing. Okay, those are the, you know, propositions that I'm using to represent my knowledge base. Okay, then these are the sentences that I have. And I'm trying to prove that not GW is entailed. That's what I'm trying to prove. Okay? So then I can convert each of these sentences into clausal form. Okay? So GW implies R or SP will become not GW or R or SP, which is already clausal. Similarly, not R or TH, not SP or TH, not TH or SG, not SG. Now, as far as this is concerned, what I want to prove is not GW. What I should then do is take the negation of that and add it to my knowledge base. So the negation of not GW is GW. Okay, now I add it to the knowledge base. One important thing to remember is that sometimes after you do the negation, you may actually have to convert it into clausal form again, because sometimes I may want to prove a conjunctive theorem. In fact, in this particular case, I could have said prove that grass is not wet and the sprinklers are not on, because you know that's what's going to happen. Prove that grass is not wet and sprinklers are not on. Okay, so in such cases, basically, so I might be actually trying to prove A and B, and if I negate A and B, then it will become not A or not B, which will be a clause. And similarly, I might be trying to prove A or B, and so negation of it will become not A and not B, and I need to basically add both of them as separate clauses to my knowledge base. Okay, right? So I have everything ready now. Everything is in the clausal form, right? So I should be able to start doing resolution. Okay, I'll just show you one trace. A successful trace essentially is one which ends in an empty clause. Because if it ends in an empty clause, that means you have shown there is an inconsistency. And if there is an inconsistency, you know that the theorem is proved. Okay, so the fact that you spent a couple of minutes and couldn't get empty clause doesn't mean anything, unless you exhausted the entire set of possible resolutions, which for propositional logic is actually feasible. If you write a systematic search algorithm, you know, for the propositional logic, you can actually exhaust the, you know, set of all possible resolutions and declare that no, this can't be proved. When we come to first order logic, we'll say that hope is out of the window. It turns out that first order logic is semi-decidable, in the sense that for a theorem prover in first order logic, if you give it a theorem that's actually true, it will be done in finite amount of time. If you give it a theorem that's not actually true, okay, then it might spend infinite amount of time not getting anywhere, because it will never exhaust the entire set of possible resolution. Okay, so now I have this, I can start resolving them. So here, I resolve that and that, GW and not GW. Okay, not surprisingly, when you start resolving, notice that the first resolution I did involved the goal clause. You know, anything that came from the goal side, we'll call it the goal clause. If you really believe that the reason there is an inconsistency is because the original knowledge base is fine, but the original knowledge base with the goal clause will be inconsistent, then it makes complete sense for you to take one of the clauses in the beginning to be the goal clause, right? So I did goal clause with this, and I get RRSP. Now, of course, one of the interesting things is this clause doesn't exist anywhere in the knowledge base. But it's been derived with one original knowledge base clause and one goal clause. So in some sense, you can think of this as son of the goal clause, or the daughter of the goal clause. One of its parents is a goal clause. Okay, if you can get an empty class with respect to this and somebody else, then that is also worth checking, because ultimately it's the consequence of the goal that's leading to the empty class. So in some sense, what I will do is actually I will take one of these classes and I will connect it to R, R, not R, R, TH, and basically what happens, not R, R, and R goes off and I get TH, R, S, P. In case you have forgotten where we are right now, by this time essentially we are saying either Timmy is happy or sprinkler is on. That's what it is. Okay. Now I connect this and that, and then I'll get is Timmy singing or sprinkler is on. Now I connect this, and I say sprinkler is on. Now I connect this sprinkler and not SP. By the way, when I choose a pair of classes to resolve, it's not all that hard, because once I decided that I'll take this as the first class, I need to look for something which has not GW in it. Otherwise, there is no resolution. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you know, you can only, you need to have one guy, one literal in opposite polarities in both classes so that you can cancel it out. Okay, so you know, in this case, since you know I got SP and the SP, there's one guy with not SP, so I combine those two and I get TH. Okay, now I can take TH and not TH, I get SG. Okay, I can do SG and not SG, and I got an empty class. Just put yourself under time pressure in the exam writing this. That's the only thing you have to do. This is why we need to learn to do programming, so that the programs will do it, not you. No, you will have to do a smaller ones of these in the exam, but ultimately, nobody in their right mind is going to do this kind of reasoning with a pen and paper, pencil and paper, to actually prove things, because you know there are not large enough sheets of paper or bored enough people in the world to do this, right? Now, one thing that this actually shows, actually, is what? It shows that every time I chose two pairs of classes to resolve, I had to decide which one to pick. I had to decide which one to pick, right? And I could have picked different pairs. And if I was unlucky, I would keep resolving classes that eventually will not get to the empty class, and the time will be over. If I'm lucky, I'll know exactly which ones to pick and I'll be done. What does this look like? This looks like search. Okay? So what I said in the last class was, I said theorem proving is being used in the CSP search, because power checking is a kind of a theorem proving. And so theorem proving was being used to improve search for models of a CSP. Now I'm saying in trying to prove theorems, you use search again. So search is inside theorem proving, which is inside search, which is inside theorem proving, which is inside search. That's the fun stuff. Okay? So now the question is, since we are thinking this is a search, so is there a search in inference? Yes, of course there is search in inference. And if you don't believe it, try to prove a reasonably large size theorem, even in propositional logic, and you know, you'll go basically mad trying to consider the different types of pairs. Okay? Many possible inferences can be done only if you are actually relevant. Okay, this brings us to the world's funniest joke. Okay, so BBC some years back has looked for, you know, basically did a popularity poll or opinion poll as to what is the world's funniest joke. And one of them, in fact, the one that at least BBC decided is the funniest joke, goes like this. Okay, how many of you know the world's funniest joke involving Sherlock Holmes and Watson? Okay, I'll tell you this. So Holmes and Watson, you know, Watson is the buddy of Sherlock Holmes. So they went on a camping trip into the mountains. Okay, and then they did their usual camping thing, and in the night they pitched a tent and went to sleep after having their camp food. Okay, so in the middle of the night, Holmes wakes up Watson and says, Watson, look up, tell me what you see, and tell me what you are able to conclude from that. This is the usual thing that Holmes used to do to Watson, right? Watson is a bozo like us, and Holmes always wants to show off that he's much smarter than Watson, and so he says, can you see the obvious pattern kind of a thing? So, you know, he wakes up Watson. Watson is already groggy. He wakes up, he looks up, and then he says the following. He says, I see stars in the sky, and from the fact that there are so many stars in the sky, I'm able to then, since they're not falling on me, then I'm able to deduce that they must be held there by some sort of a force. And since there are so many different stars, I deduce that there should be at least some other star where there is intelligent life like that, and he's going on and on. And then Holmes stops Watson and says, Watson, you idiot. This means that our tent has been swiped. Okay? Now the point is, all the things that the Watson was saying, that Watson was proving, were correct theorems. But that's not the theorem that he should be proving at that point of time. The theorem he should be proving is, my tent is gone. My God, somebody came and took my tent away. Right? Knowing what theorem to prove is different from knowing how to prove theorems. You understand what I'm saying? So if you ever forget that there is search in theorem proving, and you know, remember the Watson-Sherlock Holmes joke. Okay? There is, in fact, it turns out there is a kind of a footnote to this. This is the joke that was the number one joke in UK. And the number one joke in US was slightly different. We will get to that, you know, later on in the semester. Okay. So, anyway. So, there is such. And there are many possible inferences that can be done, only if you are actually relevant. And, in fact, in this particular case, if you consider as one of the pairs of resolvents, something that's coming from the goal, you have a better chance of actually proving negation, proving getting an empty class. By the way, the Watson example actually is more complex than what I'm trying to do here. Here I'm already tried to decide it. I've decided what I'm going to prove. And then I just proved it to myself. Watson example has an extra layer of complexity, which is what is the case for each agent in the world. They need to first prove, decide what they want to prove, and then see if it is provable. So this whole thing could have been done by Watson for every one of his theorems, such as there are stars in the world, or there are, you know, that they must be held by some force because they're not falling on me. All this stuff involves theorem proving. But none of them were theorems worth proving. In your life, I'm telling you what theorem you should prove, and still you have a question of which pair of clauses to pick together to do proving of the theorem. Okay. So, search and resolution, essentially, here is a little algorithm, a search algorithm for doing resolution reputation. Okay? You can compare this to A star search, you can compare this to CSP search, or general normal search algorithms, and see what are the similarities, what are the differences. Okay? So, you start by converting the database into the clausal form, you get a DC, which is a set of clauses. Then negate the goal and then convert it into clausal form, you get another small database called DG. Then you set up your new database D to be DC plus DG, which is basically the, you know, knowledge base in clausal form plus the negated goal in clausal form. And then you keep getting a pair of clauses, resolving them, put the resolution back into the D until one of the resolvents is empty, in which case you're done. Okay. In propositional logic, in fact, you know, when you are empty, when you get an empty class, you just say, wow, I'm done. I've proved the theorem. In first order logic, you can actually go ahead and say, for what object did you prove the theorem? And we'll get to that, you know, when you get to first order logic. Okay. So if in this loop, basically what you're saying is select a pair of clauses C1 and C2 from D. Now resolve C1 and C2 to get C12. If C12 is empty clause, you're done. Otherwise, add C12 to the D, go back to the loop. Keep doing this, okay? And if you fall out of the loop because you ran out of any new pairs of clauses to resolve, okay? And in fact, I mean, basically, you can, when you add, this could be a union. That means, you know, if this clause is already present, you don't need to add it anymore. Okay, so if there are no more new clauses to resolve, then you fall out of this loop. At this point, you can say the theorem is not entailed. The theorem is not entailed. By the way, if I come here and I say the theorem is not entailed, and if I'm trying to prove alpha, did I just prove not alpha? This is an extremely important thing. Make sure you understand this. When you are unable to prove a theorem, even by exhausting the search space, it only means that alpha is not entailed. It does not mean that not alpha is entailed. Right? Because for a theorem to be entailed by the knowledge base, so here is the knowledge base KB, and here is the set of worlds where alpha is true. Okay? And so, if this is the universe of worlds, then essentially all except this part is the worlds where not alpha is true. Notice that neither of those sets are the superset of KB worlds. So neither of them are actually entailed. Okay? So in entailment, you have excluded middle. I mean, you don't have excluded middle. Sorry. In entailment, you don't have excluded middle because it's in fact oftentimes the case that neither alpha is true nor not alpha is true. Okay? So what you did here when you came out is you can't prove alpha. And if you then can, and it's not because of your laziness. In fact, there is a world where obviously alpha is true, but knowledge base is not true. That's why you couldn't prove it. Now you can try to do the not alpha, and you will again fail, and then that means alpha is neither true or not true. Okay. So now, if I come here, then I can return failure to prove alpha. And the finiteness is guaranteed if we make sure that we never resolve the same pair of clauses more than once. Remember, add a number to clause and then never, resolve the same pair of clauses more than once. And also, when you are entering a new clause into the knowledge base, don't put it in if it's already there. Okay? And also, you should use, by the way, something called factoring, which is if you ever have a clause like QRPRP, you should write it as QRP. It turns out that even when you are doing this kind of resolution reputation, sometimes you will get these additional disjunctions, and you need to do that much simplification, at least. This is called factoring. If you do these two, then this procedure is finite, and it's complete. And so it's able to prove every theorem that's provable. I will never prove any theorem that's not provable. So this is it for us. Okay, now the question is, if it's a search strategy, how do I pick the two pair of clauses? Because the difference between you, the smart guy, and your friend, the bozo, in the exam is you, the smart guy, know exactly which two pairs of clauses, which pair of clauses to resolve and get the empty clause, and your friend is spending lots and lots and lots of time, resolving all sorts of other clauses, none of which are going to the empty clause. Okay? And so the question is, how do I pick? What are the control strategies to be used for picking a pair of clauses to resolve? I already gave you an idea. Okay? One idea is set of support. And I don't know why this happened. Let me see if I can make this smaller. One idea is set of support. Okay, I'll make it better when I go to my room, but let me put it this way now. One idea is a set of support, and what that is saying is that at least one of the clauses that you are resolving should either be a goal clause or has descended from the goal clause by resolution. Goal clause has set of support, anything that is indirectly resolved. So it's like having royal blood, okay? So as long as this clause has royal blood, the goal clause blood, then it's a goal, it's a set of support clause. And if you say, I refuse to pick a pair where at least one of them is a set of support clause, then you have reduced the number of pairs. Right? And what's interesting is this is a complete strategy. If you only do those resolutions and refuse to do resolutions where neither of the clauses has set of support, you'd still be able to prove every theorem. Okay? Again, that completeness comes from the fact that you're assuming that the inconsistency is because of the fact, not because of the knowledge base itself. Okay. The other idea, which is even more effective in terms of reducing the clauses, reducing the number of resolutions, is what's called the linear input form, where you say one of the two clauses I'm resolving must be one of the original input clauses. It's either the goal clause or knowledge base clause. You know, no clause which has actually come out after resolutions could be. I mean, I can't just resolve two clauses which are both not present in the beginning. It too reduces the number of resolutions you do, and it's very fast. In fact, it's faster than this, but unfortunately, it's incomplete. There are theorems that are true, but you can't prove it if you only use linear input form strategy. One cute thing is that under certain conditions, linear input form strategy would be complete. In particular, if your knowledge base is originally in Hahn form, then doing linear input form strategy would get you all the theorems. But if your knowledge base is in Hahn form to begin with, you shouldn't be wasting your time with resolution. You could just do, modest ponens. Okay? So if you go back to this, right? Are there any resolutions here that are not set of support resolutions? That means at least one of them is not a goal clause or something that is being derived from the goal clause. No, because essentially I started with a set of support which gave me this, and then from then onwards, so this guy now has royal blood, and I combined that to a blue guy. I still have royal blood, and now I can combine that to this guy. So I got this. This has set of support. I combined this to this. That has set of support. I combined this to this. Again, since this has set of support, this has set of support. I combined this to this, and so on. So this is actually a set of support trace. Most of the time, you should only try those because those make sense. Are these linear input form strategies? In the sense, are there any resolution here which is between two red guys? So it's linear input form too in this case. Okay? If you wind up resolving two red guys, then you have resolved two clauses, neither of which were in the original database. Okay, but as I said, in general, linear input form is not a complete strategy. It's an incomplete strategy. But it's actually much more effective in cutting down the number of resolutions. If you are into combinatorics, you can actually compute how much this cuts down and how much this cuts down in terms of the number of resolutions you have to do. Okay? Now, so having looked at this guy where we had to do a whole bunch of resolutions, we know that the whole game here is mad chase for empty clause, right? If you are doing it by hand, right, at some point of time, you are going to start hallucinating and start seeing empty clauses where they don't exist. Okay? And a classic case where people see empty clauses where they don't exist is that PRQ or not PRQ. Okay, the temptation is like doubly so. You know, normally itself you would think, oh, P or not P, now I have Q or not Q too. So I can resolve everything together in like a bundle. Okay, and I get an empty clause. What you did if you did that is you actually proved a theorem that's not true. Okay, so this is essentially saying, let's say, that either P or Q will come to your party. And this is saying, it's not the case that neither of them, I'm sorry, this is saying that either P or Q will come to the party, and this is saying that either P or Q won't come to your party. So friend one, friend two, and you're making a party, and this one is saying either friend one or friend two will come to the party, and this one is saying either friend one or friend two won't come to the party. This doesn't mean that your party is dead. There's still one of them is going to show up, and that's consistent. Do you understand what I'm saying? And if you are able to get an empty class, that's because you hallucinated. Right? You still have a party to do. Okay? And basically, the reason you do this is resolution requires that you only take one literal in each class of opposite polarities and remove them. Okay? So in fact, all you are allowed to do in this case is you can choose whichever. You can choose P or not P, and I can get to do Q or not Q. Which unfortunately is not what you wanted to prove. Q or not Q is true. That doesn't help. Okay? And similarly, you could have done the opposite and got P or not P. Neither this nor that are empty classes. Okay? So this is something that you should avoid doing. Okay? And then also remember that everything must be in CNF classes to begin with. And also remember that if you put a negation in front of the goal class, then you again have to put it back into the clausal form. Only clauses are allowed. Okay. Once you start the search in the clausal form, then you know that all the new databases will still be in the clausal form, because two clauses resolved will give you a clause. So everything will still be in clausal form. Okay? Any questions on this? Okay. So you learn theorem proving for propositional logic, which is a pretty big step forward, because when we come to first order logic, we'll say pretty much like this, except for a few extra things. We'll get you a complete procedure for first order logic. Okay? Now the interesting question is, complexity of theorem proving. And I already sort of told you this, and I'm just going to summarize this here, that as long as, if you're considering arbitrary propositional knowledge basis, complexity of proving that a theorem is true is essentially equivalent to showing that the knowledge base plus the negation of what you're trying to prove has no model. So it's like trying to prove that a CSP has no solution. And proving that a CSP, searching for a solution for CSP is NP complete. So trying to show that it has no solution is co-NP complete. Okay, so essentially this is a conjugate of the other problem. Okay, and so you expect it to be exponential time. Okay, however, if you're only interested in deriving things that are coming out by mod exponents, okay, that can be done in polynomial time. And big reason is for mod exponents there is no case analysis. That's the big reason. Now, if your database happens to only have Hahn sentences, that means when you convert it into clausal form, then they're all Hahn clauses. Okay, and the theorem that you're trying to prove, negation of that when added to the knowledge base is still leaving it in the Hahn form. And Hahn only requires that every clause has at most one positive literal. And I told you why Hahns are important, because if you don't, then you say things like A and B implies C or D, and that will force case analysis onto you, which is bad. So if in fact your database is because of your luck, is already in Hahn form, then complete inference on that knowledge base is basically polynomial, because complete inference on that knowledge base can be done with mod exponents, which is a polynomial procedure. Okay? And, if you allow all other things, if you don't have that restriction, then it's basically co-NP complete. Okay? Now, if you have a knowledge base which is more general, you can still say, you have two options. One is you can start with the knowledge base, and before you even start doing theorem proving, convert it by hook or crook into a Hahn clause knowledge base. So if it says A and B implies C or D, I say make up your mind. Either D goes or C goes. You have to make up your mind right now. Okay? And then actually in the knowledge base, only write A and B implies C, let's say. Or just ignore this entire sentence. If you do this, then essentially you have converted your knowledge base into Hahn knowledge base. But a conversion is not preserving meaning anymore. Okay, and then of course, then after in that converted knowledge base, you are happy. You will be able to prove everything using just mod exponents. But this is a dumb way of converting. The other way is to allow the knowledge base to be the way it is, but only prove some of the theorems that you feel like proving, you know, that you are able to prove. You know, so you, just because you have a general knowledge base, you don't necessarily have to use resolution. You can just use, for example, mod exponents, and that will prove a subset of theorems that you can prove. Okay? Now, proving a subset of theorems isn't bad at all. It will still be able to get you some advantages compared to not proving any theorems at all. And when was the last time we thought about that? In CSP search. You could do forward checking, which is essentially a theorem proving, which says some of the future variables won't have certain values left. You could do two consistency, which is more involved reasoning, that will get you even more inconsistencies outside. But we know that doing power checking is not bad. It does improve search. In fact, you will know for sure by project two that power checking is actually quite good, even if you don't do two consistency. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can let the knowledge base be in whichever form it is, but you only do some of the theorems, you know, that are easy to prove. And that still gets you to cut down on the search that is left in the CSP. Because some of the failures that you would have found only after 10,000 steps are being found now. And so you are really lucky in that sense. Okay? In particular, since we know mod exponents is definitely linear time, there is a different kind called unit resolution. Unit resolution, which is basically a resolution where one of the clauses must be size 1. Unit resolution is a resolution between a pair of clauses where one of the clauses must be of size 1. Okay, now obviously not all resolutions will be capturing, I mean unit resolution won't capture all resolutions. But if you say, I only want to do unit resolution, don't bother me with non-unit resolution, then I can ask, how much time would I need to do all the unit resolutions? That's polynomial time. Okay? And furthermore, the reason unit resolution is interesting is when you resolve clauses, let's say PRQ and JRW are not P, the clause size basically is not reducing. Okay, one heuristic to get empty clause is the clause size should become smaller and smaller until it becomes zero. When you do resolution of two clauses, normally the clause size doesn't reduce until, in fact, you wind up reducing, you know, until one of the clauses is actually a, you know, unit clause. In fact, if you go back to our previous example, finally I got the empty clause because SG and not SG were resolved. That's a unit resolution. Okay, so the question is, if I only do unit resolutions, then essentially I would be doing things like P or Q and not P, I'll get Q. And it turns out that unit resolution is also polynomial. And if you are doing SAT problems, which is basically doing satisfiability checking, okay, if you're doing satisfiability checking, and we know satisfiability is just a subcase of normal CSP problems, right? Now, CSP problems have forward checking. But SAT problems have only two values. So there's not that much of a use for general forward checking there. What SAT problems do, what you do in the SAT, when solving SAT problems, is essentially, so you're in doing the search, you at some point of time, you have given P is true, Q is false, W is true, etc. And then there's a whole bunch of variables below which have not yet been assigned. Right? Now, these are all unit clauses. P is true means it's a clause P. Q is false means it's a clause not Q. And W is true means it's a class W. I have a whole bunch of unit clauses raring to go. And then there's a huge number of, you know, in my constraint, all my constraints are propositional logic statements. They're also in clausal form. So I can run unit resolution at this point onto that knowledge base to see if I can derive one of the values of the one of the future variables. If I'm truly lucky, actually I will derive empty clause. Then I know that this branch is dead, so I can go up. If not, P is true, Q is true, W is true, might, after some number of unit resolutions, might say M300, which is a variable, would be false. And so then I will just, in the next level, I'll just go ahead and add M300 equal to false to my current assignment. Okay? So unit resolution is really a kind of a forward checking for satisfiability theorem provers, satisfiability model checking. Okay? And it's cheaper than doing full resolution. So choosing to do unit resolution rather than doing full resolution in the SAT search is like choosing to do only forward checking rather than two consistency or even 15 consistency in normal CSP. Because if you do more and more consistency, you spend a lot of time during the consistency enforcement. That may or may not pay off in terms of the reduced search. Okay? So unit resolution is a very useful idea. It's a subclass, and it actually captures both modus ponens of some types and modus solvens of some types. So that will capture, for example, P implies Q and not P. I'm sorry, P implies Q and not Q, it will capture that. And P implies Q and P, it will capture that too. Okay? So I'll stop here with the propositional logic, theorem proving, and all the implications of it. Next time when we come back, we will start asking questions as to whether this is enough to write all the things that we know about the world, and then go slowly into probabilistic propositional logic.